Chris Wetton, how are you?
Great. How are you?
I am fantastic. It is August 2nd, 2016. We are the real thing on the station known as morelikeradio.com. I was very, very close to saying our previous name, the Untitled Movie Podcast, but that is no more. We are the real thing. You can follow us on Twitter, the real thing, MLR. Like I said, it is the waning days of the summer movie season, and
thank God.
It feels that way, right?
It's been grueling.
It's something that we'll definitely discuss as we get into the...
I mean, there's been some high points, but...
Well, yeah, I'm obviously, but...
Like Batman versus Superman, it feels like that came out like 3 years ago.
It feels like we've been talking about it now for 3 years.
It does. I was just on an airplane. There was two movies that I could watch. You know what they were? Actually, there was three. I watched Keanu. You know what the other two movies were?
Batman versus Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And 50 Shades of Grey.
Iron Man versus Captain America, or Civil War, whatever you want to call it.
Really? Already?
Yeah, three channels. Keanu Reeves, or it's not Keanu Reeves, well, his name is Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
Keanu, Batman versus Superman, and Civil War.
Ah, Jesus.
It's like those two movies for me to choose from. Airline is now going to be called, you know, United Airlines versus Chris Wetton, because that was an attack.
Against your civil liberties.
Against my liberties, yeah.
Well, let's get to the numbers, as we always do on The Real Thing. And your number one movie this past weekend was Jason Bourne. Jason Bourne, which made $59.2 million, and it was not bested by, in order, Star Trek Beyond. Bad Moms, which actually came in third place and made all of its money back.
And was well reviewed.
Had a $20 million budget, made $23 million. And then your top five is rounded out with Kitty Fair, The Secret Lives of Pets, and Ice Age Collision Course.
Kitty Fair. I'm not allowed within 100 yards of
And yet, in spite of Jason Bourne, and this is the one of the main topics that we'll be talking about on The Real Thing today, is that, Chris, how excited were you for this movie?
Oh, we've talked about this, like, a lot. You know, I mean, like, I think we looked at, you know, lists of movies back in the spring of what was coming out, and both of us were like, yeah, Batman versus Superman, Civil War,
Ghostbusters.
Yeah, Ghostbusters, yeah, Jason Bourne, oh my God! Yeah, like, both of us, I think, right, were, like, super pumped about this. I love the Bourne series. The Bourne series, to me, like, throughout the years, I have elevated it to a status that is reserved for sort of classics from my childhood. Like, to me, it was, like, on level with Indiana Jones trilogy or the original Star Wars trilogy or something like that. It's like, I can watch that trilogy, and I watch one of them, I have to watch the next two. Like, I can't just watch the Bourne Supremacy. Like, if I'm flicking around the channels and Bourne Supremacy is on...
Right.
I literally stand up and go, fuck this. And I go to the movies and I put in, you know, Bourne Identity,
yeah,
and then Supremacy, and then Ultimatum. I love that trilogy.
And they all hold up on their own. I mean, in spite Absolutely. Of the fact that you do have to watch them as a trilogy, and as a reminder, the Bourne Identity was actually directed by Doug Liman.
Doug Liman, yep.
Who did Go, who did Swingers, who did Edge of Tomorrow, another great action movie. And then the last two in that trilogy, Supremacy and Ultimatum, were directed by Paul Greengrass.
Right.
Now, this latest one, Jason Bourne, was again directed by Paul Greengrass.
Yes, different writer, though.
Different writer. No Tony Gilroy.
Tony Gilroy's gone, and then the editor from the previous movies gave an assist with the script, co-wrote the script with Paul Greengrass, which I think is interesting.
Okay.
We'll get into that.
Yeah, and here's the thing. It's a layup.
I
feel like it's Casey at the bat. That poem where it's, you know, you've got Jason Bourne, it's not some other actor that's playing Jason Bourne, it's Matt Damon. You got the original director from arguably two of the best movies in the trilogy. You've got Vincent Cassell as the bad guy. You've got Tommy Lee Jones as the slimy CIA director.
Alicia Vikander, you know, just won an Academy Award, you know, as in a great part, you know, essentially the Joan Allen part from the previous movies.
Yes. All of these things put together, and you would think that they're just going to knock it out of the park. There's no... I came in with such high expectations to watch this movie. I know that you did as well. And yet... Well, I'm going to let you go first.
Yeah. Well, you've set the stage there. Same thing. I did have high expectations for this movie, and I try not to do that most of the time when I go to the movies. I try not to have expectations, even for something that I am personally anticipating. I kind of try and keep it, you know, at bay.
Tempered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Temper that. A better word, as James Spader would say in Wolf. Did they hit it out of the park? No. I don't even know, like, they hit it, like, they hit, like, a grounder to third base, like, you know, like, directly to third base, like, everything about it, all the ingredients are there.
Okay.
It seems like, at first glance, all the ingredients are there.
Right.
But it doesn't add up to what feels like a Bourne movie, for some reason. First of all, there's a lot more action in it than there normally is in Bourne movies. And I think that has to do with the fact that the writer of the movie is an editor. And I think probably when he writes, maybe he thinks like an editor. And he is designing scenes and structures of scenes that sort of, he's imagining how they get cut together.
Okay.
But it doesn't really have the intelligence of the previous Bourne movies. I don't know where the smart Jason Bourne character is, but he's not in this movie. And for me personally, that's the thing that I love the most about the other movies, is how smart Jason Bourne is.
Mm-hmm.
Not how he can, you know, knock people out with one punch as he does in this movie.
Right.
Like, that's not Jason Bourne, right. You know? Jason Bourne is not, you know, although, yes, he is trained in hand-to-hand combat, that his defining characteristic is not that he's, you know, Mickey the one-punch machine gun from Snatch, you know,
right.
Like, which is how they play him in this movie. Like, I was looking for a good fight there, and it was just like, one punch, Jason Bourne knocked the guy out.
Yeah.
So I don't think the movie doesn't work for fans of Bourne. Maybe it works for someone who's never seen these movies, or who doesn't necessarily put these movies on the level that you and I do. For
okay.
those people, probably this movie seems just like every other Bourne movie.
Okay.
But I think for a super fan like myself, it didn't have it. It just didn't have it. Against all odds, like we said, it's got Paul Greengrass, it's got Jason Bourne, Tommy Lee Jones, Alicia Vikander, Vincent Cassell, who I love.
Yeah.
It's got the interesting locales, whether it's Athens or London or Vegas, which seems ripe for, you
yeah.
know, a Jason Bourne chase. It's got the chases. It's got several big chases. And it even sort of hits some of the same notes from the other movies, which sort of strikes false. Like, and spoiler alerts, by the way, for anyone who's listening to this.
Yeah, yeah,
we're
yeah.
not going to be able to talk about this movie without spoiling some things. So if you're here and you haven't seen the movie, maybe tune back in again later.
Right.
The scene in the beginning of the movie where, you know, he's sort of meeting up with Nikki Parsons.
Yes.
And she hops on the back of the motorcycle. At no point during that entire sequence did I feel like Nikki Parsons was not going to die at the end of that sequence. It was just telegraphed all over it.
Right.
And it's essentially the same scene from the beginning of The Bourne Supremacy, where Marie Kreutz, his girlfriend, dies and
right.
is shot in a very similar way, actually. There's a chase going on.
Yeah.
The guy who's pursuing them
yeah.
loses his car or is no longer able to pursue them by car, goes on foot, gets to a vantage point and with a sniper rifle and blows her out, you know, just like the Carl Urban character did.
Which, by the way, no trace of him.
Yeah,
at all.
I know. I don't know. I read that he was in it, so I don't know what's up with that. That was misinformation.
And I was even waiting for him.
You're waiting for it?
Yeah, I was waiting for a flashback or something, and then, you know, all the flashbacks had. Who's the actor that played his dad? He's in Slither.
Oh, yeah. Clark Gregg.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, he's in a lot of movies. He's
Payback.
Payback,
yeah.
Yeah, he's in Body Double, one of the cheesy Brian De Palma movies from the 80s.
But anyway.
Been in a lot of movies for years and years. Yeah, yeah. I liked seeing another, you know, good character actor showing up. You know, flashbacks with Albert Finney and all kinds of. And the movie's just loaded with good actors.
Yeah.
The guy from Nightcrawler, Riz, and The Night Of, you know, what's his name? Playing the tech guy, Riz Ahmed,
I think
his name.
Yes, you're correct.
The entire movie basically is exposition, flashback, action sequence. That's how this movie works. And again, that sounds like the recipe for a Jason Bourne movie.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't work.
Right.
It, for some reason, it doesn't feel like Jason Bourne. And to me, again, one of the big reasons is because he doesn't seem very smart. And he's not the aggressor. At no point in this movie, and this is probably the most important thing for me for a Bourne movie, he is never the aggressor in this movie. He's on the defense from the beginning of the movie to the absolute end of the movie. He's on the defensive. At no point does he turn the tables, which is the quintessential Jason Bourne move. Like, there's that quintessential move. Like, what's he doing in the consulate in Berlin using his passport? We know that he knows that we're looking for him. Like, right. Jason Bourne wouldn't do that. He knows what he's doing. There's no moment like that in this movie. Doesn't happen. It's difficult to articulate because, again, all of the ingredients are there. It's like if I give you all the ingredients to make me a Big Mac and I literally get the ingredients from a McDonald's, you know, and I bring them back to my house and I thaw them out and you make me the Big Mac.
Yeah.
But for some reason...
It's not a Big Mac.
It's not a Big Mac.
No. It's an Arch Deluxe. and a very shitty one at that.
Royale with cheese.
The very first problem that I had with this movie is that, okay, look, I've seen the trailer a couple times. I didn't want to burn myself out with the trailer, but I was very kind of baffled that the fight that he's in Morocco, I think, one of those countries, mm-hmm. in a very dusty, sandy country.
Yes, yes.
Because he's essentially trying to beat himself to freedom or something like that. The one punch machine that you're talking about, wrong angle. Yeah.
But he fell the wrong way.
He fell funny. No, he didn't fall funny. But no, the one punch that he does and knocks the other guy out, and they showed it a million times in the trailer.
Yeah.
That perspective isn't shown in the movie. It's over his shoulder. So I was
they
like,
do that thing.
So I'm
sometimes.
Like, huh, that's weird. Tommy Lee Jones is good. Vincent Cassell was all right. I get the whole revenge plot. It's kind of tacked on. You know what it was like? You know, I read a review, and I was kind of worried, and it'll go into something that I'm going to talk about later on The Real Thing on morelikeradio.com, but it was describing this movie as like a greatest hits album.
Yes.
All the things that you remember from... You know, all of the movies and the actors and the thing that they did and all that sort of thing. They're coming back together.
Yeah.
They're showing it to you one more time. It's the same thing.
Yep.
And yet it feels just kind of like they're just going through the motions. Like, don't mess it up. Don't screw up.
Well, they do that. Just what you're talking about is what they do with the Nikki Parsons scene where she gets shot. They do it again later on in the movie when Bourne is going to meet up with one of many CIA characters, and he has him meet in a very crowded area, just like he did in the Bourne Ultimatum. And it's the guy, you know, the Andes from Hot Fuzz.
Yeah.
That guy, Patty Considine, I think is the actor's name in Ultimatum. He meets up with him, and he's trying to meet up with this guy in this heavy area, and he's like, hey, stay, I'll keep you safe and all this kind of stuff. And what do you know? The guy ends up, you know, killed or whatever.
Yeah.
Exact same scene in this movie.
Yeah.
It's a greatest hits moment, just like you're talking about.
Here's the other thing, too, is that I know Alicia Vikander won Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah, Supporting Actress.
For the most famous movie, Getting Your Dick Cut Off, as you've mentioned it before, with Eddie Redmayne, a.k.a. Eddie Gucci Mane.
True that. Not a bad movie.
I wasn't impressed. I was not impressed with it. That's acting? Really?
Yeah.
Like, there's... I mean, okay, look. I get that she, you know, finally turns and starts helping Jason Bourne. Then she's not. Then she is. And the ending, by the way, like the very, very end of the movie, kind of threw me off.
Oh, we gotta get into the ending.
But all that being said, her delivery, her monotone delivery, I might add, it wasn't. I wasn't
Everyone
impressed.
Everyone in the movie felt bored to me. And you said Tommy Lee Jones was good. I'm sorry, Tommy Lee Jones looked bored as hell in this movie, didn't he? And Tommy Lee Jones is not known for being an actor that's tremendously emotive or anything. That's kind of his thing is that he's sort of got those like thoughtful eyes as he's like just letting what the other character on screen is it's sort of washing over him, but you can see the intelligence behind him, and that's there, but it's just they don't give him anything to do. You get an actor like Tommy Lee Jones or an actor like Alicia Vikander or an actor like Vincent Cassell, or for that matter, back to my original point, an actor like Matt Damon, who is so good. One of the things about Matt Damon is he does seem so smart, and so he's believable. Not only as someone who can kick your ass, that's fine. Any actor can pump up. But Matt Damon has, and some people might disagree with me, but I think most people do agree.
Charisma.
He has charisma and a believable intelligence. And maybe that's because we've seen him speak in interviews. And he is an intelligent guy. You know, he's a bright guy.
Well, the movie that he just did was The Martian. And he was very, very good in that.
Yeah, he's a botanist, you know. And he was nominated for an Academy Award, I think, right?
So,
but there's no smart Bourne in this movie. It's like, here's a perfect example. He's in the scene where he goes to the Julian Assange type character, yeah. Right? This Christian Dissault or whatever.
The evil vampire?
The evil vampire.
Yeah.
So this guy is essentially a WikiLeaks Julian Assange type character that they set up. There's a lot of mirroring of reality in this particular Bourne, more so than any other Bourne movie that's ever been made.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a very thinly veiled Julian Assange character that he's sort of involved with via Nicky Parsons. He goes to this guy's apartment because he wants him to read some encrypted documents that he has or whatever.
Right.
Lots of reading of documents in this movie.
A lot of reading of documents, a lot of direction, a lot more directions. I felt like Bourne GPS. That's what I felt like the movie needed to be called, too.
Yeah, Bourne GPS. Yeah, Stillborn, as I called it.
Or the Bourne identity.
The Bourne identity. Yeah, honestly, that's what I was thinking as I'm watching it. I was like, this fucking Bourne identity.
Yeah, but anyway, go ahead with the Julian
Assange. Lots of exposition, lots of... So he goes there for more exposition, more reading of documents and flashbacks. And the CIA, who seemingly can see everything that's going on the planet at all times, it sort of, like, taps into the room... turns off the computer, and then actually taps into the room and calls him. And I think, I don't know what city it's in. You know, the CIA...
That was in Berlin.
In Langley or whatever.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
This scene with the WikiLeaks guys going on in Berlin. They're tapping into the room, turning the computer off, and then they make the phone in the room ring and speak to him via that cell phone that is physically in the room on the other side of the planet.
Yeah.
And then, and of course, they're dispatching a team there to take care of him right away.
Yeah.
One other character sends him a text message simultaneously saying, a team is on its way.
Yeah.
And he genuinely looks surprised. Like, they just tapped into your room from the other side of the planet, turned your computer off, and called you. You're speaking to them on the phone.
Yeah.
You're now surprised that they're sending a team in to whack you?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. Jason Bourne wouldn't do that. He's the guy that sees everything... you know, 20 miles ahead of when it's happening. Again, back to the Bourne supremacy. When he's telling Marie Kreutz at the beginning of the movie, when he sees Carl Urban.
Yeah.
It's wrong. Just this guy, the guy, his clothes, the car, it's all wrong.
Yeah,
and guess what? He's right.
Right.
Because he's Jason Bourne.
Well, here's the other thing, too, is that now that you brought up Bourne supremacy, when he kills that other operative that he apparently had called in whatever it was called, the thermostat. He's I thought I had to call it in.
Yeah, yeah.
Then that guy gets his ass beat with a magazine. Or in the Bourne Identity, where the one guy crashes through the window,
yes.
and Jason Bourne beats the crap out of him with a pen.
Right.
Or
Frosted
when
tips guy.
Right. Or in the Bourne Ultimatum, when he kills Desch with a fucking towel and also uses a book reading his fundamental motherfucker, and he starts beating the crap out of him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There wasn't anything like that in this movie.
No.
There was one.
None of him using his surroundings. Kind of thing.
Improvisation.
Yeah.
Julian Assange got a chair leg knocked over his head, and then One Punch McGee decides to take a trip around Europe. Jason Bourne.
One Punch McGee.
Jason Bourne. I thought for a couple times I was like, you know what? This poor bastard. No wonder he's so bored, because he probably has brain damage because he keeps landing four or five stories every single time.
And gets right back
and
up.
And he gets right back up.
It's like a Jason Voorhees quality at this point. Like the spill that he takes, where the characters actually say in the movie, like he fell five stories.
Yeah.
You know, and he just gets up and walks away. It's like, what? No broken collarbone, no broken jaw, no subdural hematoma,
So I was reminded of what you were talking about when we were discussing Ghostbusters, and the reason why Ghostbuster was made, the remake, was because of money.
Yeah.
It's not making money.
Yeah.
This movie is probably going to break even. It was $120 million. It's already made half of that. It's going to get international sales and everything else.
No, but it's gonna be a
make money. But you have to break it back down to the fact that the only reason why Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass got back together, in spite of years and years of saying it's not going
to
happen,
there's no reason to do it.
There's
they literally
no fun.
Said those kind of things.
Yeah, we're tired of doing these movies. It's not fun anymore.
Right.
Et cetera, et cetera. It was made for money, and it showed.
Right. It did show, and the script feels reverse engineered as a result of that.
Because of the editor doing the screenplay.
Well, partially, yes. Well, I think that has to do with why the movie is so action-heavy, the editor doing the screenplay.
Okay.
But it also feels reverse-engineered in that in the first three movies, he's essentially trying to figure out who his identity is. It's called the Bourne Identity.
Yeah.
And at the end of the third movie, he does.
Yeah.
And so I think what they were faced with was, okay, we're going to make a Bourne movie, but Bourne already knows who he is. So what are we going to do? Is this just going to be a, you know, sentient Bourne who knows who he is and what's he doing and all this kind of stuff?
Yeah.
They said, no, we got to make him still trying to figure out something about himself. So
let's give him 10 programs to look at.
Right. Give him some documents to read for about, you know, 3/4 of the movie.
Right.
So they had to sort of reverse engineer another lapse in his memory, which I don't think you necessarily cared about at the end of the third movie. You find out he's David Webb, and it's like, he just wanted to know who he is. But now they got to reverse engineer a story about more of his identity that he's trying to find, which has to do with his father and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so because they did that, because they went back and reverse engineered something that really wasn't a part of the original story, it doesn't feel organic. It doesn't feel like the real story. It feels like you're saying, which is they just made this. It's tacked on, made this for money.
Yeah.
I thought it would have been more interesting. And then we get to the end of the movie, which is, first of all, the Alicia Vikander is one of the, you know, as we said, the Joan Allen character.
Yes.
CIA, yes, but a moral compass and likable for the whole movie. That's why we like this character. That's why she likes Jason Bourne. She recognizes that he is, as she says, a patriot and that he has a moral compass.
Right.
His character is designed that way. And then they give you a scene at the end of the movie where she completely abandons that. For no reason whatsoever.
Well,
Other than to have a cool Bourne moment at the end of the movie, which, and play, and, you know, drop the Moby music.
drop Extreme Ways.
How fucking happy is Moby when he hears that they're making a new Bourne movie? And Moby's like, yes!
Let me tell you something. My friend Nick Ennis was like, you know Moby is just jerking off in his little one-bedroom apartment in New York.
And onto his spinning turntable.
He's like, oh, God, thank you so much, Jason Bourne. Thank you so much, Universal Pictures.
I get another million in you know, rights for them using that.
Yeah, and which, by the way, the version in this movie is crap.
It's fucked up. Yeah, they even messed that up.
Yeah, they fucked that movie. The music for it now, oh my God.
I just kept thinking of the moment from A History of Violence with William Hurt after they're trying to kill Viggo Mortensen, and they just fuck it up, and William Hurt's just, like, befuddled and just keeps repeating,
How did you fuck it up?
Like, these movies are relatively simple.
Yeah.
You need the exposition, you need the flashbacks, you need the action, but you gotta have some smarts and some intrigue in there.
Yeah.
And this movie didn't have it. And that, as to that action, which I do think was there so much because of
The lack of story. Yeah.
And you got an editor, and editors think in pictures. And movies are a visual medium, so it's important that you have some interesting visuals, and these are action movies, so you gotta have action.
Yeah.
I felt like it had too much. The first, you know, like, 4/5 of the movie, the action is fine. The chase scene in Vegas. The chase scene in Vegas takes these movies for the first time ever to what I would classify as a Die Hard 4, Live Free or Die Harder level of action. Seriously, which is, you know, like, I remember sitting in Die Hard 4 and thinking, like, John McClane is not a superhero, you know?
Right.
Like, he can't do these things that defy physics, you know? I mean,
the
first movie and, you know, fine, the second and the third movie of both those series that we're talking about. Like, there's some moments where it's like,
I can't believe that just happened.
Yeah. But it's not like, well, that's physically impossible.
Like John McClane standing on top of an F-16 Harrier jet.
Exactly.
Sliding down a Tiger Trump and it explodes and all that crap.
Also, you could also point to, you know, the Indiana Jones series. Like, some supernatural elements in them always, but always at the end. And after the movie had sort of gained your confidence by, you know, building a great story and interesting characters and funny moments and stuff. So you forgive some face melting at the end because it's like, you know, whatever, I'm into this.
But not nuking the fridge and falling
down.
Then
you get to where they nuke the fridge in the first 5 minutes of the movie and you're like, okay, well, you clearly are not even trying here.
Yeah.
That's what that Vegas scene at the end of this movie is like. You know, like Vincent Cassell steals a armored car.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't steal a bullet train from Tokyo. He steals an armored car. And even a bullet train from Tokyo couldn't do what this armored car does. Like, he's going 60 miles an hour down the Vegas Strip, you know, with Jason Bourne in hot pursuit in another police vehicle, not an armored car.
Charger.
A Charger, yeah. And he's just, Vincent Cassell is just fucking plowing through stuck cars at a standstill.
It's cartoonishly
it is cartoonishly ridiculous.
Like, I think it's cartoonishly awesome. I'm sorry.
In a way, it is. Yeah. Because that's all the movie really has to offer is ridiculous action. Well, but I mean, like, literally, how many cars does he plow through?
At least 12.
12?
Yeah.
Sure. I was going to say, like, 50. But, okay, fine. Let's go with 12.
Let's go with 12.
This is an armored car. Like, there would be some damage on it. Like, it just plows through these things like butter. You know, like, it just, like, these things are 3,000 pounds or whatever a car is, 4,000, 5,000 pounds, you know, and, like, and they're just, like, ba-doom, 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 you know, flying off this thing.
And
like,
still going the same speed.
And he's just going the same speed, like, and there's also no damage to the front of the vehicle. I understand it's an armored car, but it literally looks like the special effects guys took a thing of baby powder and just dumped it on the front of the car. Like, that's the only damage that it suffered. Headlights still work, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah, just like sprinkled some baby powder on the front of the thing.
I think by the time
looks
I got...
like he drove through a flower factory.
Two things. By the time I got to that part, I was so bored with the movie anyway. I was like, I need anything. Because, okay, wait.
Absolutely.
Well, let's go back. Let's go back to how Jason Bourne, he's supposed to be the most intelligent guy in these movies. He's 5, 10, 15 steps ahead of everybody else. But he's dropped in the middle of a tech convention. And he's just taking shit. Just, you know, like...
How convenient.
Free swag. You're not even trying Jason Bourne. Like, you're really not. And then...
And they literally, he passes by two tables, and one of them's like, you know, track anyone. And he picks up one of the trackers. The next table's like, record a conversation from 50 feet away. Like, I'm surprised he didn't pass the find your lost CIA daddy table, you know?
Like, right. You know what did a better job of trying to, you know, infiltrate and, you know, record voices and everything as far as espionage is concerned? Zootopia. The last movie that I saw.
Yes.
Okay. So there's that. Number one, I was bored, and then this car chase happens. And then number two, I think that my next car is going to be a Dodge Charger, and it's not going to be because of this car chase. I was thinking of buying a car anyway, it was completely insane. And then you would think that okay, maybe they got their head out of their ass and everything else, and they've got this car chase, and the car does this, and everything's crashing through. Like I was thinking to myself, this is only the second best Las Vegas Strip car chase scene that I've ever seen, because first has got to be Con Air. I mean, come on,
but I'll give it to Con Air.
And then they're chasing each other like heat, like Robert De Niro, Al Pacino style, and then they fight in this. Fucking, like, it's too goddamn dark. It's too fucking dark. I can't see shit.
Well, it's like a sewer. And he was, like, 20 minutes earlier, like, on his phone, like, reading the map of the sewers of Las Vegas. Like, it almost seemed like he was doing that just so they could have a fight there, you know?
Right.
Like, it didn't make sense. It was, like, literally, like, the directors forgot that they left that scene in there. Like, oh, yeah, we gotta have a fight in a sewer. Oh, shit. Vincent Cassell's reading the map of the sewer. That's really telegraphed. You know, these movies, like, make me realize, too, that I could never be... Like a born guy or like a CIA operative, because it's like it's gotta happen like 4 times in the movie. Somebody gets a text message and it's like Statue of Athena, 10 minutes. I'd be like, dude, I was gonna take a shower. you know, like Bourne at the beginning of the movie just finishes like he's in a bare knuckle brawl with this guy like for some cash. Nikki Parsons leaves him a little note on it. This is like. 1 hour, town square.
Yeah, after
what the fuck?
After he just got the shit beat out of
just
him,
got my ass beat.
But then, like, he sees. Oh, it's the Save the Last Dance chick. Oh, like I'm gonna kick this guy's ass.
Oh yeah.
1 hour.
Let's get this fight over with. I got 1 hour to, get on Nikki Parsons here.
Jesus Christ. So anyway,
also, there's certain words that can never be uttered in a movie again. Like you can't do it. Here, I'll give you an example.
Okay.
You can no longer say, in any movie from now until the end of time,
okay.
You cannot say the word enhance.
Enhance. Yes,
you cannot say that movie.
Just print the damn thing.
Super Troopers has ruined it for you. I don't care that you're making a Jason Bourne movie or a James Bond movie or a CIA movie. You cannot use the word enhance ever again. It's over. That word is done. And how many scenes in this movie were there of CIA guys in, like, blue glow rooms looking at screens, you know? Like, if you take out scenes of CIA guys in rooms with blue screens, or, like, pictures of old documents, like PDF files of old documents, this movie's, like, 11 minutes long.
Yeah, and I know that Ultimatum definitely had a lot of those scenes, too, but better story.
Better story. And, you know, like, not cartoon. The Tommy Lee Jones character is relatively cartoonish in his,
evilness.
Yeah, he's they should have given him the mustache that he had in Natural Born Killers, so that he could stroke it,
Right.
Or, like, the But he does everything but tie Alicia Vikander to train tracks in this movie, you know? And another thing, as like a waiter in like Langley, where the CIA headquarters is, a waiter at a restaurant, you see two CIA guys walk in, you must be like, oh, fuck. Because they never finish a meal. Like, it happens in, I think, like at least 3 out of the 4 Bourne movies where they go in for a meal. Waiter comes over, you know, I think David Strathairn orders like an egg white omelet, like heart healthy omelet in the third movie, like Joan Allen orders something. They order it, they have a tense conversation, and they both leave. The waiters are like, ah, CIA guys, I'm not even going over there.
God damn it, really? The mimosa is just sitting there now. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Joan Allen.
I'm going to take back to the bus room.
Pamela Landy, you cheap piece of shit.
No moments like, get some sleep, Pam. You look tired.
Oh, I thought that, okay, look, one last thing. The ending. We've already established that it's problematic. I thought that the car was going to explode.
Oh, really?
I thought it was going to. I thought that she plays this thing. It's recorded. It's the gotcha moment. You're screwed. And then nothing. He just walks away. He just walks away to go down the...
See, I never predict anything in movies. I'm sort of famous with my wife for never, for like, not seeing things coming. And she's like, yeah, you didn't see that coming? Seriously?
Yeah.
But that I saw coming. Because, like I said... The character, the Alicia Vikander character, she completely abandons all her morals in that moment in the car with the guy prior to the Jason Bourne scene.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense that she would do that.
Right.
The only reason it makes sense is so that you can have the Jason Bourne moment where he... And also, I would like to see like the behind-the-scenes stuff where... You know, not behind the scenes, but like the cut shot of, you know, Jason Bourne like sneaking over like Bugs Bunny to the car and opening the passenger door and like dropping the camera in there, you know?
Holding up a sign.
Is she looking? You know, like he runs over there like, I gotta have a tense conversation with her, but first I gotta sneak this into her car so it'll be really cool. I could just show it to her when I'm standing there, but it's gonna be way cooler if I say, I'll get back to you. And then she sees it for herself.
My God.
What a disappointment.
Yeah, it's... I'm not going to hold hope on any sequel moving forward, which...
Wouldn't it have been more interesting to see the sort of... Like, for him to come in, like they talk about in the movie? Like, hey, shake the series up. It's no longer about the Bourne identity. It's about him being an operative for the CIA again.
Sure.
And trying to, like, something interesting. Bring something new to the table. This movie didn't do that.
Well, here's the thing now. The Bourne legacy is better than this movie because it took...
I was thinking the exact same thing.
Took a chance.
Took a chance, tried something new, at least. This movie doesn't do that.
Yeah.
Who would have thought 2 weeks ago that this would be the fifth best Bourne movie?
Wow.
That may be how it goes down.
That's depressing. Well, let me perk up your attitude and your interest on the real thing on morelikeradio.com, Chris. I know for a fact that we have talked about this before. And I mentioned this was because last Friday, I had the opportunity to see Guns N' Roses play live in Orlando, which was for their Not In This Lifetime tour. It's been, I don't even know how the stars aligned, but you got Axl Rose, you've got Duff McKagan, you've got Slash, you've got basically the principal band members for Guns N' Roses together, and believe it or not, they played a fucking awesome show.
Yeah, everyone keeps saying that. It was amazing.
I had low expectations for this.
Yeah.
Because I was reading the same article that I was referring to before where it was comparing Jason Bourne to a greatest hits album or a greatest hits tour, and everyone's just kind of there and they're doing their thing and then they get off stage.
Right.
This, I can't tell you how overwhelmed my expectations were blown away. For example, I'm just going to play a very, very quick clip. But this is Guns N' Roses beginning with, this is the fourth song. And they played like 25 songs, but this is, this is them playing Welcome to the Jungle. The fourth song, mind you. Okay, now I bring all this up, and it was a good album and everything else. We're not a music podcast, so it's okay. But
yeah, Guns N' Roses, we can make an exception.
But I bring this up because is the song "You Could Be Mine" the most badass song that has ever been in a movie ever?
Oh crap! It's pretty badass. It is in the movie, but it's not in the movie in a badass moment, right? Like, it's sort of playing as they're, like, on the motorbike, on the dirt bike, like,
right,
speeding off.
Right, while what's-his-name with the redhead goes,
yeah,
on the
like, fist-pumping in the air and whatnot.
Yeah, it was originally not going to be the official theme of Terminator 2. This is per Wikipedia.
Cocaine tone.
It was originally going to be I Want to Be Sedated by the Ramones.
Oof. God, good choice, James Cameron.
However, apparently James Cameron decided to recruit the band to perform a song, and then as it turned out, the part where Arnold Schwarzenegger is walking down the hallway to meet with John Connor, and then the T-1000 comes out, and he pulls
slow-mo,
out...
roses.
Roses and a gun.
Oh!
Yeah.
I never even picked up on that before.
Neither did I until I read it. But
wow.
Yeah. And so
that's sort of where he got the idea, or that was like a nod to recruiting them?
That was a nod to recruiting them.
Wow.
And so... But yeah, I remember that, you know, they were playing the song. They obviously played You Could Be Mine at the show.
It might be the most badass song from a movie. The scene it's in the movie is not particularly great. However, you cannot hear that song and not associate it with the movie.
No, because it had the music video
with Schwarzenegger walking around the concert, you know?
Yeah, and he's like trying to like assess the band after they walk out backstage, and it says Waste of Ammo whenever he's looking at W. Axl Rose. And
yes, yes.
So...
However, it's not in nowhere near as good as that, but I will also say that they had another great music moment in a movie, Guns N' Roses did, when they did what I think is a really good cover of Sympathy for the Devil in Interview with the Vampire.
Oh, yeah!
Which does play in a really cool moment in the movie, which is at the very end of the movie where Tom Cruise, as Lestat, sort of coming back to life, steals the car with Christian Slater in it and is driving away while Sympathy for the Devil plays by Guns N' Roses.
That's right.
Actually a really good movie music moment. So they have two.
That's cool, but yeah, I was very interested after I had seen the band, and then I was, you know, obviously listening to a bunch of, you know, Guns N' Roses albums, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, and then I had seen the video up again, and so yeah, You Could Be Mine is my pick as far as a badass song. I mean, obviously there are other songs that you could probably put in there, like Danger Zone with Kenny Loggins. Or
Take My Breath Away from the same movie.
Shit. Maybe the one that's like quintessentially like directed, you know, connected with the movie, not directed, connected with the movie, like Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody with Wayne's World.
Yes. I would also add maybe Where Is My Mind from Fight Club.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is sort of a moment like that was not even in the book, the moment that they used that in. However, the addition of that song to that moment in the movie makes it better than the ending of the book. Like, the two go together perfectly, like peanut butter and chocolate, you know?
Nice. All right. Well, let me move on to... Speaking of music. Ladies and gentlemen, we are still in the midst of a contentious election year, and Donald Trump...
Believe me.
Everyone's favorite Republican presidential nominee.
Not really a Republican, but okay.
Okay, sure. But apparently he's been chastised a couple times from various bands. Queen, for example, for using We Are the Champions during the Republican National Convention.
Right, Brian May was kind of shitty about it.
And apparently,
it should be, I guess.
And apparently he had used the producer of the Harrison Ford thriller Air Force One. Said that the Republican presidential nominee is using the deceased composer Jerry Goldsmith's music without permission, and he wants him to stop.
From Air Force One?
Yes.
Yeah, that's so typical Trump. It's like, hey, what's a good movie about the president I can watch tonight? And he, like, watches it. That's probably how he envisions his presidency, actually. You know, it's like him knocking guys out. He essentially says that. You know, there's a bunch of guys I'd like to knock out. He said that about the DNC last week.
Yeah, but apparently he had...
Jerry Goldsmith. Oh, that guy's dead, you know? But, like, he stomps on, like, the memory of, like, dead soldiers and things like that. He did that this week and stuff. So I guess Goldsmith is, like, you know...
Yeah, quote...
collateral damage.
Trump has been broadcasting the Air Force One theme for months at campaign rallies across the country. The most recent and high-profile use of the score occurred on July 20th when it accompanied Trump's dramatic arrival via helicopter at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
So it's kind of an obscure reference, too, you know?
Like, yeah.
Very few people are going to hear that and think of, you know, like, think of the movie Air Force One, but maybe there's, like, a subliminal thing going on. It was a popular movie. When's the last time you saw Air Force One?
Jesus. When did it come out?
Let me ask you an even better... It was, like, 1997. Even
probably
better question.
Probably 1998.
When's the last time you saw the crash of the plane from Air Force One at the end of the movie.
It's really bad. It's very, very bad.
It's like James Bond riding the wave in Die Another Day bad. Like, how was this not national news at the time? You know,
it's like Nintendo 64 graphics.
Oh God, shit! Like, that's an insult to Nintendo 64. Like, it's Super Nintendo at best. We're talking, we're talking Dreamcast here.
This is the first time that Trump's choice of music has come under fire. Multiple songwriters and recording artists have asked Trump to stop playing their music, including the Rolling Stones, Neil Young, Adele, Aerosmith, and R.E.M. And so, there
Adele.
You go.
He's playing Adele.
We could have had it all, Chris. We could have had it all, but unfortunately we are still in the midst of the single weirdest election in my lifetime, that's for damn sure.
Oh, well, anybody's lifetime.
Yeah, pretty much.
So bizarre. Maybe that should be his music when he walks in. How bizarre song from the late 90s.
OMC.
OMC. That's bizarre. What he should. They'd probably be like, yeah, okay. It's fine. You can play it. Yeah, we're not getting any plays.
Speaking of the last time that I saw Air Force One, you were mentioning as far as 90s...
Get off my plane!
90s movies are concerned. Oh, and then there's the
drop... Stop playing my music!
Then there's the scream that Gary Oldman does. Fire!
I forgot about that.
Oh, it's so good that Howard Stern plays all the time. Some other anniversaries to consider as far as movies that had come out several years ago in this past week. Mm. Pee-wee's Big Adventure came out in 1985. Mm. Waterworld came out in 1995.
Damn, I love Waterworld.
And The Mask came out in 1994.
Who cares? God, The Mask has not aged well. It was a crazy year for Jim Carrey, though, right? Like, all three of those movies came out in 1995. Like, he had that year where it started with Ace Ventura. Like, because before that, he was just the white guy from In Living Color.
Right.
And then Ace Ventura came out, which is a huge hit. And then The Mask came out, huge hit. And then later that year, Dumb and Dumber, right? Like, I think they all three came out in the same year. It's pretty insane to think about that.
Yeah.
And two of them actually hold up really, really well. The Mask, unfortunately, does not. What was the other one? What was the other anniversary movie there?
Waterworld.
Hell yeah. Kevin Reynolds.
Never seen it.
What?
Never seen it.
Dude.
I gotta watch it. I'll watch it.
It is one of those movies, though, that now you watch it and you're gonna be like, what the fuck is Chris talking about?
Well, no. Well, wait a minute. Wait.
It harkens back to a time when things were, like, you know, movies were a big deal. Like, you know, having $100 million movies these days, it's like, $100 million movie. You know, most recent Woody Allen movie is probably $100 million.
Right.
But back then it was a big deal. It was like supposedly a bomb, even though it did make money. And it's actually a fun movie, you know, like it's interesting.
Right. Well, I'll counter your comment by saying that your suggestion of watching Nothing to Lose, which by the way is super fucking funny movie.
Now that surprised me that it holds up to someone who did not see it nearly 20 years ago when it came out.
Yeah, Tim Robbins and Martin Lawrence, a buddy cop, odd couple movie.
Essentially a buddy cop movie. Yeah, odd couple. Yeah.
There's like five parts in there. I was laughing my ass off.
Very quotable movie.
Yeah. Where they're just all around, there's just four guys telling each other to shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Those two guys too. You know, that was what's his name?
John C. McGinley.
John C. McGinley, and you know who the other guy was?
Shit.
Los Pollos Hermanos.
That's right.
Yeah.
What's his name? Gustavo? Is that Gustavo Fring?
Gus, that was him.
Holy fuck.
Yeah.
You just blew my fucking mind.
I know, right?
Holy crap.
Great movie. I love that movie.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm a scared man.
Just stop it on shit.
There's a spider on your head. Hey man, I don't speak your jive talk. What does that mean? There's a spider on my head. Love that movie.
All right. Well, how about this? How about we've got obviously there's the loud response
I'm just thinking about that movie and all the funny moments.
The loud response from moviegoers this summer. In regards, would you say that the average moviegoer is, quite frankly, sick of sequels and just kind of Hollywood male-eating when it comes to, you know, all these ideas?
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of magnified by Jason Bourne this week. As a matter of fact, I was thinking, I disliked the movie so much, or the experience of watching it, I was thinking to myself, would I rather watch this again or Ghostbusters?
Ooh.
Which one would I rather see again? And strangely enough,
I'd rather watch Ghostbusters.
I liked Ghostbusters even less than you did, but in 6 months' time, if you ask me that question, you'll say, okay, I'm going to put one of these discs in. Which one's it going to be?
Yeah.
I probably would watch Ghostbusters.
Yeah, at least they're trying to have fun.
They're trying. Like, yeah. And it didn't feel like they were trying. There's levels of trying.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel like they were trying right after I saw it. And then I saw Jason Bourne. I'm like, oh, wow, this really is what not trying feels like. You know, like,
right,
so
right.
I'm going to give it to them, the girls from Ghostbusters.
Like, okay, well, how about this? Apparently, there are in the works. Disney's in the early stages of developing a reboot of the 1991 cult classic The Rocketeer. According to The Hollywood Reporter, the reboot is more of a sequel and will retain the period piece with the new story set 6 years after the events of the original movie. However, there's a modern spin, as the new protagonist will be female, and sources to THR claim that Disney is looking for a suitable African-American actress to take on the mantle.
Okay. Why? That's weird. Like, I'm all for, like, women getting more roles and black women getting more roles, but then if you go like specifically after a particular race and gender, then it feels weird. It's like it's gonna be a reboot, but it's gonna be a black girl. You know, it's like that's your whole thing. Like,
yeah,
I'm fine with it if you get the right actor or the right actress. Perfectly fine.
Okay,
but it does feel weird, and this is back to the Ghostbusters thing when you haven't even written a script yet, and you're announcing that it's going to be a black girl. Like, that's your whole thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
If I announce to you that I have a script, and it's just from scratch, I'm going to tell you the story, and who the main character is, and what happens, and what, you know, obstacle he overcomes, and how the movie ends, and all that kind of stuff. If I just go, hey, I'm going to write a movie, it's going to be Rocketeer with a black girl. Like, that, then it's like, oh, okay, well, you're just making Rocketeer with a black girl. Like, fine, make a movie with a black girl if you want to, but, like, that can't be the crux of your entire story.
Okay, well, how about this? I counter... He played a stripper in Magic Mike and an action hero in 21 Jump Street, but Channing Tatum's latest character is not what you'd expect. Tatum will be playing a mermaid in the gender-flipping remake of the 80s movie Splash, it has been announced.
Merman!
He will also produce the movie, co-starring actor Cillian Bell, in the part that Tom Hanks originally played.
My fucking wife will be there.
No.
Probably have to be there too, unfortunately. Who's the chick?
Cillian Bell, who is the... She's in Workaholics. She's oh, okay. She's the bad person in 22 Jump Street.
Okay, fine, whatever.
Yeah,
that's weird. Like, again, this feels like the Rocketeer thing or the Ghostbusters thing, which is like, okay, you got nothing, so you're just gonna go, we're gonna make Splash, but guess what? Now, first of all, Splash is really good. Have you seen Splash?
I've never seen Splash.
God damn you, what have you been doing your whole fucking life? Splash is really fucking good. It was back in the days before Tom Hanks was Tom Hanks. Like, he was just a goofy guy.
Right, I've seen... Okay,
curly hair,
look, like, I've seen Volunteers, and I've seen Jovers the Volcano, and I've seen The Burbs.
God, I haven't even seen fucking Volunteers. Jeez. You should see Splash. Splash is a really cute movie.
Okay.
And very, very sweet movie. John Candy is in it, like, steals every scene that he's in. He
okay.
plays his sort of, like, it's back in the days when you could cast two guys as brothers and they didn't have to look anything alike.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, nobody gave a shit. Oh, yeah, Tom Hanks and John Candy. Yeah, they're brothers, sure. I think they're half brothers or something like that, but they're really close. His name's Freddy, and he is really funny in this movie.
Is he?
Eugene Levy is sort of the villain in the movie, one of the villains in the movie. Tom Hanks is brilliant. It's one of those great 80s comedies, really, really underrated in terms of sweetness and humor. And these guys are just going to remake it and say, oh, well, you know, it's going to be that, but, you know, Channing Tatum, who is talented. Like,
yeah.
The Coen Brothers movie that he was in for, like, you know, a sneeze or whatever, like, he was funny in that little moment that he was in it.
Hail
like,
Sneezer?
Hail Sneezer. Yeah. Would that it were.
It's complicated.
It's complicated. Would that it were. Why are you saying that way, my good man? No,
so
I mean...
It's out of your mouth.
It's another reboot, another remake. Like, hey, just, you know what? You're already changing it that much.
Yeah.
Just call it something else.
Okay, well...
And don't announce it as a reboot.
Let me...
This is called Merman, or whatever.
Yeah.
Merman. With an exclamation point.
Well, let me give you some hope.
Dancing around in your underpants.
Are you serious? I just told you.
I just told you. Why male models?
Back in May of this year, Tim Burton, director Tim Burton, had said
thanks
that,
for clarifying,
that the had seen that the stars were aligning for Beetlejuice 2 to be remade. Stars Michael Keaton and Winona Ryder were on board for a follow up to the 1988 fantasy comedy. However, Michael Keaton has indicated that now, quote, that ship may have sailed on the sequel during an interview with Variety. No, zero. The only way to do it is to do it right. So much of it was improvised and so much of it was beautifully made by the artist that is Tim Burton. If you can't get close to that, you leave it alone.
Good. Jesus. You know, have we not learned anything from Jason Bourne or Zoolander 2 or Anchorman 2, or, you know, like any of the other number of other sequels that have come out 10 or more years after the last one.
Yeah.
Mad Max is the exception. You know, not everybody is, George Miller. And not every story. Mad Max is the exception. It's not the rule. The rule is Zoolander 2 or Anchorman 2. You know, and Beetlejuice is funny. And if you'd made a sequel back then, fine. But I think when you try and make sequels to things 20 years later, like, I can't think of, or Godfather 3, another good example.
Yeah.
I can't think of an example other than Mad Max, and that's not really even a sequel. Like, that's just kind of like a James Bond thing, where they're just picking up the mantle and doing the exact same thing with somebody else.
Right.
It doesn't work. And Michael Keaton's right. Like, God, as an artist, isn't that freaking boring to you to just want to, like, rehash the same old stuff over and over again, you know? I don't know. Like, I don't know, musicians, I feel sorry for them too, because, like, this is what it's like for them to play concerts, as you were talking about with Guns N' Roses. Like, alright, here we go, we're going to play Sweet Child of Mine again. Like, I've only played this song 17 million times, you know, but I got to make it seem like that. And musicians, God bless them, they're able to do it.
Yeah.
Like, you go see them in concert, but, like, Michael Keaton can't even do it twice. You know, you ask him to do it one more time, he's like, fuck no. You know, like,
I'm gonna go raise my kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go raise my kids. I'm gonna go live in Montana or wherever he lives.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in Michael Keaton doing something new and interesting, not playing Beetlejuice again. We have Beetlejuice. If you wanna watch Beetlejuice, watch Beetlejuice.
Right.
You
know? Speaking of Michael Keaton, and this was something that just completely blew my mind, but apparently he just received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Yeah, Donald Trump's had one for 20 years or whatever it
the
is.
The 2,585th star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, honoring a career that has included a Best Actor Oscar nomination, and obviously he was Batman in two films.
How long does that Walk of Fame, was that Walk of Fame made it to Sacramento yet? Because, like,
probably.
Everybody's got one of these things, you know? How did Michael Keaton not have... God damn it. I would hate to read the list of people that got their star on the Walk of Fame before a great actor like Michael Keaton. You know, it's probably Miley Cyrus and, you know, Donald Trump. Not joking. Like, he has a star on the Walk of Fame.
Oh, there's a wall built around the star.
People built a wall around it, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And I think that I also read of someone taking a dump on it, too, which is nice.
that's appropriate.
All the people that got stars before Michael Keaton's probably... Oh, my God.
Keaton's first starring role was the 1982 comedy Night Shift. Later in the 80s, Keaton starred in Mr. Mom, Gung Ho, Beetlejuice, Clean and Sober.
All good movies. Night Shift, even. Funny. You know, it's like dated early 80s comedy, but it's got some really, really funny moments in it.
Yeah.
Gung Ho, same. Mr. Mom's one of my personal favorites. Love Mr. Mom.
Dude, I love the Dream Team.
Dream Team is great.
I love the Dream Team.
Our good friend Josh Baber's a huge fan of the Dream Team also. Yeah.
Nice. Well, as we wrap up on the Untitled Movie Podcast... This is the other topic that I wanted to talk to you about. And that is that someone brought up, I think it was Jason Hornsby. Hello, Jason. Fuck you, Jason. Jason had brought up that he had been walking in a neighborhood and he saw some guy or was looking at a guy who was just unabashedly, without any sort of abandon, singing We Belong Together from the movie Grease.
No, I think you read that wrong. It was Jason that was singing it.
It was Jason that was singing it.
He was telling a story about the fact that...
That makes it way
somebody
worse.
Somebody was doing that, and the joke is that it was him. God. I believe. You'll correct us if we're wrong, Jason.
You can if you want. But my point being, for our last topic tonight, is that I can't think of a movie that I hate more than the movie Grease.
What?
I fucking hate that goddamn piece of shit movie.
Why?
And I'll tell you why. My first job was working as an ice cream scooper at Davey's Ice Cream, and they ended up switching management and ownership, and the new ownership, when they came through, it was I was friends with Guy and Melissa Miller. They used to go to high school with myself, John Langford, a bunch of other people that worked over there, Brad Register, and they turned it into a 50s cafe, 50s cafe that all they played every fucking day. Was the goddamn Grease soundtrack.
This has happened to me with a couple songs. Like, remember at Blockbuster we had the trailer tape?
Movie Tunes.
We would get the new trailer. Well, that was at AMC, Movie Tunes.
Right? Oh, okay.
But we had the trailer tape at Blockbuster. Same thing. Every month we would get a new one, and we at the movie theater you could sort of tune it out. Like, you were, you know, like blowing the theater out with a leaf blower, or you were doing, it was loud, and you didn't always hear it.
In fact, right.
Most of the time you couldn't hear it.
Right. Or if you did like I did, and I ended up getting in trouble for this, you end up putting, you know, like the Boogie Nights soundtrack in the scene. Like, you can't play play that.
Yeah, we frequently did that. And it would take hours before anyone would notice. Right. Yeah. I think I played the Beatles' White Album for like 3 weeks one time. but at Blockbuster, like, you couldn't tune it out. And I remember there's a couple songs that I, like, my frontal brain is not even aware of it.
Yeah.
But, like, then they get played, and I have, like, a Jason Bourne reaction. Like, I, like, jump out of my seat and start doing karate when I hear these songs.
Fucking
like
twitchy.
Twitchy, yeah. Like, I think Semi-Charmed Life from, like, what was that?
Third Eye Blind.
That was one of them. There's a couple others. Like, oh, my God. I think Short Skirt, Long Jacket from Cake, which is a band I love, but it was on the trailer tape, so I'm like, I can't listen to it. Like, I can't hear it.
Right, and how long did you have to have those tapes play? Because they were
like
monthly.
They were monthly, I think. Yeah, we would get a new trailer tape. We'd be like, oh, new trailer tape. You know, and some months it would be really good. You know, like, you would have, there's 8 songs on there. There's a lot of, like, commercials and, like, hey, Krippendorf's Tribe is out. You know, like, Richard Dreyfuss is a wacky college professor who creates and there's a lot of that kind of stuff.
Right.
And then they would cut to, like, and here's Semi-Charmed Life, Room 3. So you would get 8 songs between all of the, you know, talking about new movies and stuff. Some months it would be 6 out of 8 songs were, like, pretty good. And maybe the other 2 were just ignorable. And then some months it would be, like, 8 terrible songs. Like, it's The Wallflowers and it's, you know.
Oh,
like,
not The Wallflowers. God. Not One Headlight.
Yeah. What are they doing now? Man, they were really prescient when they named their name their band The Wallflower. Should have been called The Has-Beens. Like,
you know their first music video, Sixth Avenue Heartache? Mm-hmm. You know who directed that, right?
No.
David Fincher.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they also made the song from the Heroes remake for Godzilla.
Oh, shit, so fuck them. Yeah, I forgot that.
First of all, for being involved in that awful Godzilla movie, and second of all, for remaking a David Bowie song. Don't do that. Don't do that.
Okay, but my question to you is that, what movie do you just unabashedly hate, just irrational thought, just completely filters into your brain, I don't care what you say, it doesn't matter, Grease is mine, what's yours?
Oh, God. I don't know if there's any movie that I hate that much. There's sort of, like, genres of movies, or sort of, like, I don't know if there's any specific ones, but, like, you know, like, the kind of, like, silly, like, Kate Hudson or Jennifer Lopez movies from the early 2000s.
Made in Manhattan.
Like Made in Manhattan.
How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Like, that kind of stuff to me is, like, it's pretty hard for me to watch. Like, it's pretty hard for me to watch that kind of stuff. I can't think of any movie that I hate as much as you hate Grease.
Jesus, man. And you know what? It would be something if, you know, the movie were at least kind of good. And I know that people like Grease. You know, it's very precious to them, and they grew up with it, and it's, you know, greaser and all that shit. But
yeah. I will tell you one.
It's very rapey, number one.
It's rapey?
Well, there's that one song, tell me more. Oh, tell me more. Did she put up a fight?
Oh, well.
Fuck are you.
Tell me more. Did he rape you on the beach?
But then also, it's, you know, like the thing that they always make fun of now where, you know, like, hey, these cool high school teenagers. How old are you? I'm 45.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I don't know. I like Grease. Maybe, I don't know. I sort of grew up watching it. We had it on VHS. And I don't like a lot of musicals. And I don't love Grease, but I sort of like it. So I kind of, you know, sort of smiled along when I read Jason Hornsby's comments this morning.
I literally barfed in my mouth.
Him reading it. Like, it would be funnier if he was just sort of walking through a neighborhood and saw some random guy in his house
that's
screaming
what I thought.
Grease lyrics at the top of his lungs. No, it was him. It was him. One movie did pop into my mind that I see it periodically on cable. I hated it when I first saw it. I hate it. I've tried again to watch it, and I've hated it. I've seen pieces of it as I flip through, and I will sort of stop on it and just remark about how terrible it is.
Okay.
Big Fish by Tim Burton.
Never seen it.
It is such a sort of shameless attempt at being deep and profound, and it comes off so schmaltzy and so thick, and it's also at the simultaneously trying to be as Tim Burton as Tim Burton has ever been. So it's attempting to be dark, and there's circus folk and freaks and all this kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And it just all feels like it was concocted in a Tim Burton laboratory. And I do not like Tim Burton, you know. So the movie is him at his most bombastic and his most Burton-esque. I don't agree with the aforementioned comments from Michael Keaton that he's a great artist. Oh. Like, maybe he was at one point, but I think he sort of peaked with Ed Wood. And Big Fish is a real, real schmaltzy attempt, I think, at trying to get an Oscar, actually. I think that's what he was sort of doing.
Wasn't that the movie that he made right after that Planet of the Apes remake that he did in 2000?
Perhaps. That sounds about right. Yeah. Because it was like very early 2000s. Yeah, right around in there. Maybe 2003. Yeah,
I think Pearl Jam did a song for that soundtrack, too.
Exactly. Yeah. That's like, well, no. You get Pearl Jam because you're trying to be cool.
Yeah, you're trying to be like emoting feelings.
Yeah, feelings. Yeah, feelings rock, you know.
Feelings rock.
That's what they are, you know. And I love Pearl Jam, but they are feelings rock, you know. Yeah. Like yeah, I hate Big Fish.
Big Fish. Well, then I'm not going to watch Big Fish. I was going to have this whole aquatic a series of movies I'm going to watch. Splash, I'm going to watch Waterworld and Big Fish, but Big Fish is out.
I'll give you another one. Yeah, take Big Fish out.
Okay.
Another one for me is Moonrise Kingdom and pretty much anything that Wes Anderson has made in the last, I don't know, 10 years.
Since Royal Tenenbaums?
I sort of enjoyed Fantastic Mr. Fox. That might be because my kids enjoyed watching it. But, No. Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou was the last one that I truly enjoyed.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And then there was the one on the train, but, you know.
Darjeeling Limited?
Yeah. And that one was like, okay, well, we're going to do this again. Okay. Yeah. Right, well, fine. What's next? And then he made another one. And then he made another one. And then he made another one. And I guess that the Grand Budapest Hotel, like, everybody sort of went nuts over it. And I'm like, everybody, hey, this guy's been doing this for 25 years now. Like,
well, no, like when they're starting to make, the Saturday Night Live parody of
exactly
a Wes Anderson horror movie.
That is better. That is better than any Wes Anderson movie that has been made.
I'm going to kill you with a phonograph.
10 years. Yeah. So I just get like, it just, that to me is what Grease is to you. And it's sort of the same thing that Big Fish has. Like, it's like, look at us. We're making art, you know, this is an art movie. Like, everyone's got their little idiosyncrasies that, like, they're not characters. They're just, like, collections of idiosyncrasies. Like, all these characters, quote unquote. And I can't stand it. I just can't stand it. I would like to see him do something different.
Yeah.
You know, people make the argument, too. They'll say, like, you know, oh, Woody Allen's been making the same movie for, you know, 50 years or whatever it is. And it's like, well, you can sort of say that. But if you watch all his movies, you can't really say that because he has made dramas and he has made comedies. And even amongst comedies, he's made sort of wacky screwball comedies and he's made sort of dark comedies. And he's been all over the place. Wes Anderson doesn't do that. Wes Anderson has been making the exact same tone with the exact same color palette and the exact same actors and some of the same jokes and pretty much all the same music, like over and over, and the same themes.
Yeah.
You know, like people that like feel outsiders in their own world and in their own family.
And now
like,
here's a Kink song.
Right, and here's a Kink song, exactly.
Yeah.
Here is Mark Mothersbaugh, you know, tinklinking on the piano, you know, like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah, sorry, everybody.
Oh, that's okay. But I am going to watch Splash, now that you mentioned it. And I'll check out Waterworld, too, but...
if you're going to pick one, pick Splash.
Splash, okay. Well, I'll check that out. So we will be back next week. You're not going anywhere, are you?
I might be going up to see our friends Josh and our friend Brandon up in Gainesville.
Oh, cool.
But I think I should be back in time for a show Sunday.
Excellent, because I think I'm going to watch Suicide Squad.
Oh, I'm going to see it. I'll see it. I'll probably see it early on Saturday.
Yeah, I'll probably see it same day, too. I think I'm going to go to Orlando and meet with some friends. But in the meantime... The
reviews are not good.
They're not good. But we will wait until next week on The Real Thing on MoreLikeRadio.com to discuss this movie. And so, as always, Chris Whetton, thank you so much for your input and your expertise.
Likewise, I enjoyed it.
And follow us on Twitter, The Real Thing, R-E-E-L, on The Real Thing MLR. You can also follow Chris, because Chris finally has a tweet account.
How do you know that?
Because it showed me on my phone.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's...
That's some Jason Bourne shit.
Wet tweet.
Yeah, wet tweet, yeah.
W-H-E-T-T-W-E-E-T.
Something like that. And I only did it so I could read what Donald Trump was saying during the DNC speeches the other night. I wanted to read it in real time.
And then you can follow me, Mark_Nixon_. But we will leave you with the better, more... The better version, the best version of Moby's Extreme Ways from the Bourne trilogy.
Best man, the better man.
Playing for the... I can't remember the quote.
Yeah. Self-taught, no lessons. Thank you, Dad.
Thank you, Steve Buscemi. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, audience. And we'll see you next week.